This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program features two really wonderful women poets, Camille Dungy and Elizabeth Bradfield. I'm going to give you an intro for Camille Dungy a little bit later in the program. We're going to start off with Elizabeth Bradfield. She is the author of two full collections of poetry, Interpretive Work, which won the Audre Lorde Award and was a finalist for a Lambda Literary Award, and more recently, Approaching Ice, a book of poems about Arctic and Antarctic exploration that was a finalist for the James Laughlin Award from the Academy of American Poets. Bradfield's poetry has shown up in all kinds of places, and she has been awarded fellowships and scholarships from Stanford University's Wallace Stegner Fellowship Program, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, their Vermont Studio Center, and elsewhere. In 2005, she founded Broadsided, and you can check this out at broadsidedpress.org. She still runs this. It's a grassroots virtual collaborative press. Broadsides are made and are put up in the streets all over the place. So check out broadsidedpress.org. She grew up in Tacoma, Washington, and received her MFA in poetry from the University of Alaska, where she lived for 5 years. She now lives on Cape Cod and works as a web designer and naturalist locally and on expedition ships around the world. She tends to veer towards the higher latitudes north and south. So I am going to play a recording now that I made while in Boston this year. This is Elizabeth Bradfield.
Well, it's great to be here at AWP, away from the madding crowd with Camille Dungy. And I'm looking forward to hearing from Smith Blue, her book. And I want to read some newer poems of my own from a manuscript in progress, hopefully near the end of the road, called Once Removed. And the poems I want to read, I might read some other stuff as well. We'll see how time does. But I want to read poems that I've been writing in response to videos by Demet Taşpınar, who's a Turkish video artist who I worked with in Antarctica. I was a naturalist, and she was the ship's doctor. And afterwards, we exchanged information, and she had these beautiful lyric videos of quite abstracted of water and of ice. And so I wrote these poems to accompany the videos, and it was a really different way of working and writing for me to know I had, you know, 8 minutes to write is a really bizarre concept for me. And it was interesting. So I'm going to read the three of those that I've done, and then we'll see how things go, and I might read another poem. The first poem is long-ish. It's the longest of the three, and it's called Deliquescence, a Meditation in Seven Parts. One, verb, to melt away or disappear as if by melting. How many hours have I stood before water attempting this, and when did the urge begin? I can feel concrete beneath my feet, wooden rail underhand, wind, blackberries scenting up the steep clay bank that the stairs followed down in a suspended, wobbled reach to the beach. Always a gull hovering at eye level, at rest in wind. Was I 5, 5, 9, 16? I stood and stared at the bay, at water, at what I might, O soft, persistent hope, dissolve to. Italian has a better word, liquescere, to become liquid. Liquescere, liquescere, the world whispered, whispers to me. 2. Chemistry. Become liquid by absorbing moisture from the air. Dawn on the bow, or some hour early enough to be, for at least a while, alone. Firm horizon denied by mist. Prow rocking forward into swell. Forward, only forward, it seems. The air's liquid palpable in silence. Horizon of skin blurred. the body's liquid, not separate, pulsing, held, selfless. We are, by vast percentage, see. The eye can stand to be open only through tears. We see wetly, salt, wet sea. A bit of spray, and I taste it. Ocean. There is no voice, no other to ask or exclaim, and so disrupt this delicate experiment that, to survive, I run. Sky becomes water, water, sky, and I dissolve, dwindle, disband, disperse, dissipate, become delinquent to the self. 3. Liquidare, Italian, to liquidate, to get rid of. Yes, says the tide edge. Yes, the spindrift, the mare's tail, the nimbus, the veil cloud's vellum, upon which nothing can be written. Yes, ice slurries from a glacier. Yes, ice brash and rafted, driven by wind, willing to dissolve, despite the fact that it could not resist. 4. Origin, from the Latin, dissolve, mid-18th century. Enlightenment, what you've given us, the unweighting of ideas, architecture, science itself freed to reach beyond Earth's edge, peer beneath the ocean's lens. Halley's diving bell lowered, a man at its clapper, church of sea, breathing not with, but at least beside, fish, squid, barnacle, scallop. And the sky, too, breached. Stars seen not as a dome's flaws, but tidal, drifting heat. I never wanted to become the night sky, to disappear into that height. The heavens are a poor attempt of sea. They whisper nothing, just burn in silence. At night, the sea has much to say to itself, to us. It has its own stars. To be within them, body a shadow in phosphor, is at once closer and further from my goal than anything. I am nearly, I am not. Deliquesce hisses a wave to the sand. Deliquesce, deliquesce, deliquesce. Yes. 5. Biology. To branch into many fine divisions as leaf veins. Tide flows in, floods into all narrowings, all ends and origins. What can float is lifted. What can't be lifted is covered. Surface glint hides resistance in sky. 6. Botany. To become fluid or soft on maturing, as some fungi. Do we become softer with age or more brittle? Lunar empathy and solar habit each have their pull by which the tides of self are governed. It is harder and harder to leave the stiff forest of I, a life cultivates. The trunks of self thicken. Saplings rise, ready to replace whatever falls. The wafted drift of meadow in which I began has been supplanted. But wind moves through, rain slides every leaf. I try to remind myself, thick and stolid as I feel, much as I'm able to resist it, to bend. I try to remember how I flew, weightless in an ocean of womb. Liquescere, liquescere, and also liquefare, to melt. Amore, liquefare. Afternoons in bed, light filtered through the curtain, we manage to drift beyond singularity. 7. Deliquescence, the liquid resulting from the process of deliquescing. This water, this cloud, light, liquid, shiftless resistance, this rendering of all we might become. So that's the longest of these video collaborations. And the other two are shorter. I can't decide which one to read next. I think maybe this one, which is called Travel of the Light. And it has a lot of nautical references, a lot of references to navigation and to wayfinding of one way, shape, or form. I'm fascinated by old and contemporary ways of navigating the ocean, of how you get around in a landscape that shifts beneath you. And so I talk about different map makers in different parts of the world. And in the end, I talk a little bit about the navigation of birds. And there's amazing experiments that have been done on birds kept in cages, showing that some inner clock, you know, deprived of light, deprived of any sense of the outside world, they know which way to go and when to begin their migration. It's an amazing thing. If you want to read more about it, Living on the Wind by Scott Wiedensahl is a great book about bird migration. Travel of the Light. In the north, maps were not made from an envisioned height, but lo, from the skin boat, a piece of wood or bone held up to horizon, carved, so peaks spoke to peaks, aligned as home. Let me search back. Let me search for landmarks, for clear and fixed positions. I remember the airport in Tucson. You found me at my gate, waiting to leave. Love, you said, and marked me. That waypoint, that beginning. South Pacific maps were baskets of wind and wave, vector and junction. Sky breath, pitch and yaw, enough to cross what seems featureless. Some pasts we need to be untraceable. When she left her house, my grandmother threw out 60, 70 years of diaries. She did not offer them. I've always loved the skillful monsters and unsettled edges of old maps. I can tell how hard they were trying. My heart, I am so often lost. How do we map our time apart? When the first to this ice wandered it, were blinded by its days-long glare, they ate birds, found rocks inside the gut, evidence of shore beneath the shore that continues to revise itself. How and when do we fix memory or learn what to forget? A navigator knows time and distance magnify small errors. What is the course steered compared to the track made good? What set? What drift? In laboratory dark, birds leap toward their routes. Their inked feet prove again and again that they know which way and when to begin. I feel like I should describe these videos to you. One of them will be available, though, on the Rumpus in April of 2013. So you can look there. And one will be shown on the website for Alaska Quarterly Review in the nebulous future. The last of the video collaborations, and we hope to do some more, but those are not yet even in the works, is called To Find Stars in Another Language. You do not know the story yet, although its glister is familiar, and the way its source is dampened by the blanket of words we make for it. Yes, you know each word, but not all in constellation. There was once. To see these stars, you must allow the possibility of the epic. Sail 2 days toward the white land surrounded by a vast cold moat. Birds with mythic wings will assess you askance with one of their pale, cold eyes. Be warned, they are not your familiars. Their needs do not correspond with yours. Once there was. Then you arrive, and the stars, after all, are not so unlike those that have tented all your ordinary nights. They, too, are lonely. They are lonely. They mutter and wrestle in glistered conversations. You can't know if they'll ever settle. Still, had you the right time lens, all stars would look like this, would refuse the stories, archer, queen, dog, that seem timeless. There once was a boy who longed to become. There once was a girl who longed to become. Look, squint, let every distant light escape from story's snare and be. The other poems in this manuscript are tonally pretty different. I think of it as, this is the mean book, I think. I think it would be hard to transfer ourselves really quickly into that tone. So I might end with a poem about something that happened this last summer. It's called The Truro Bear. And those who are readers of Mary Oliver might know that 30 years ago, she published a poem called The Truro Bear. And last summer, 2012, on Cape Cod, a bear came to Cape Cod. An actual black bear wandered across the Cape Cod Canal. It was on the bridge. It wasn't on the bridge because video cameras didn't capture it there. So it must have swum across and went all the way from the beginning of the Cape out toward the end of it, toward Provincetown. And the story is in the poem, so I won't go too much more into it. But I moved back to Cape Cod after living in Alaska, and I've been missing bears quite a bit. So to have a bear in our woods again was pretty wonderful in my book. The Truro Bear. I am lonely for the bear, two towns south and heading here. The bear, too, is lonely. For what other reason would it swim the canal than walk the whole of the Cape toward us? Mornings, we rise early, drive, look in places we'd like to see it. Evenings, the same. Scat, a track, a tuft of hair would be enough. We don't mind ticks or briars, although we're troubled that highway drivers see it and not us. One man catches it on infrared in his backyard, light bulb of a hind end and narrow legs sauntering. Orleans, Wellfleet, Depot Road, then at Bradford and Conwell, the busiest intersection in town. This will be the summer I don't return to Alaska. This will be the summer I won't visit the woods where I learned to walk with bears. Then, steaming home from a day on the water, we hear a distress call from a boat off Wood End. The black bear has lost power, is being set ashore. We turn, stand by, until they get the anchor out, drop it, feel it catch. Rust stains every plank of the blue hull. The black bear, I'm not kidding. Bob says they made the same call yesterday. This, then, is what I get. The next day, or the one after, officials dispatch teams with darts and nets, and the bear is gone. Things are fine for a while, although our chit-chat at the post office or in the market feels small, mean. Then we hear it's headed back our way. They shoot it out of a Boston suburb's tree and truck it west again to the woods they think it came from. But it was coming back. It was young, restless, lonely. It had found plenty here. Berries, acorns, skate tails on the beach, ground unclaimed. I was lonely at that age. I wandered. Now I will be, the woods will be, the ponds and bogs and briars will be so lonely for the bear. They know how alive they were at its low shrug through them. But for a while at least, we were re-enchanted, our gossip urgent and hopeful. We loved our loneliness then.
You've been listening to Elizabeth Bradfield reading a number of new poems. You can go to ebradfield.com to find out more about Elizabeth and her very interesting work. And I think she'll be joining us again near the end of the program. But right now we're going to turn to Camille Dungy. As Elizabeth mentioned at the beginning of the program, we were all at the AWP conference, the Associated Writers Conference in Boston. There were 12,000 people there. It was madness. So it was really nice to all of a sudden find ourselves, three women poets, in a nice quiet hotel room making these recordings. So Camille Dungy is the author of Smith Blue, winner of the 2010 Crab Orchard Open Book Prize, Suck on the Marrow, and What to Eat, What to Drink, What to Leave for Poison. Those are three wonderful books. She is also the editor of Black Nature, Four Centuries of African American Nature Poetry. And she's the co-editor of From the Fish House, an anthology of poems that sing, rhyme, resound, syncopate, alliterate, and just plain sound great. I played a number of poems from that book, which comes with a CD last year. She is assistant editor of Gathering Ground, a reader celebrating Kaveh Kanem's first decade. And she has also received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Virginia Commission for the Arts, Kaveh Kanem, the Dana Award, and Breadloaf. She is also a two-time recipient of the Northern California Book Award. So please welcome Camille Dungy.
Hi, I'm Camille Dungy, and I'm happy to be in the Word Temple. I'm happy to just be here with poetry. Sometimes we move through the day in such a bustle, and it is a pleasure and a kind of blessing to be able to stop and be still with language and what it can do with the body and to the body. And so it's a delight for me to be able to share this hour with Elizabeth Bradfield, whose poems I have long admired, and to share some of my own poems with you as well. And so I was thinking about the body and the way that I re-enter the body through language sometimes, that I would read you a poem called Five for Truth. One. Maybe you too have heard something, but haven't seen the thing. Wondered longer than a moment at a sound that sounds like the moan of a man losing his spleen to a gull's beak. It is likely only a bull seal reporting to his neighbors, but you know something of seals. Imagine the sailor who, in 1682, saw his first seal. Its bloat and bob and doggish float, so like and unlike a waterlogged man's, drew up a body to buoy the sound of his shipwrecked fears. Once, 2 hours past midnight and three continents from home, I heard a wild boar rooting just outside my camp. Certainly, we all have heard something we haven't seen, and the hearing, which should have been an answer, has become a question instead. It's wood cracking. Under what weight? It's a rock sliding. Where? Two. The old man has mistaken his niece for his sister. And would you fault his memory, its vision? Are you the lone one who has never confused one face with another's name? But it was you, remember, who mistook the other black girl for the one your friend said you should get to know. And it was you, or someone quite like you in appearance, who, thinking he was somebody famous, positioned yourself beside that no one on the train. These misperceptions are nothing that hasn't happened before. You've heard, perhaps, of the masseuse who gained his sight at 50? Everything he knew in blindness turned into something slightly horrible with sight. His cat, his dog, the animals he loved, the stiff or swollen limbs of clients, all these were varied, textured, wonderful beneath his fingers, but hardly differentiable now before his unaccustomed eyes. 3. I have never been afraid of water, and yet I am always a little afraid of what might be floating in it. Take stingrays, take leeches, take sharks. Take my friend who, on the beach at age 4, found a pretty thing to play with, a Portuguese man of war. My fear is the fear of his mother seeing her son, his mouth almost inside the luminous jelly. Certain fear touches us like that, leaving only the taste of its skin on our tongue. Who isn't afraid of being the one disaster touches? They say it's normal, but the way lately, if I pull the skin along my clavicle, it folds easily and brings with it all that loose flesh. This is mostly all I have to worry and be glad about. Feeling my own body growing old. 4. When gambling your senses, wager taste. You'd still have touch, so you would know what textures you chewed. You'd have sight. Like Johnny Carson, who had no taste, you'd still have your lips, your American teeth, even probably your tongue. Life is a chain of compensations. My friend, who drinks and smokes and snorts the occasional powdered drug, says she'll throw herself from the top of a Mayan temple when the cancer settles in. I've seen this friend gash her forehead on the fan hung over a bar she danced on and watched her keep dancing through the end of her tequila and 2 songs. I wonder if my friend knows at which stage of her ruin exactly she plans to let herself fly.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to Camille Dungy.
5. One thing I like about the nose is how it lacks imagination. Just last night, I woke up dreaming of a body in the forest. No one I recognized. Maggots busily erasing the flesh around her nostrils, her impossibly twisted arm. Or was it alongside a road, her body? Where are we turning up dead girls these days? Fruit in her hand. Though I would not, it was so ripe it seemed a shame not to taste it. I could feel the moss she rested in springing up after my discovering feet passed. I could imagine hearing how she'd caterwauled in terror. In my bed last night, I woke up afraid to touch her because I knew how she would feel and I wanted nothing to do with that feeling. One thing I don't like about the imagination is how it can turn against me when I let it go. Let me, now please, bless my nose, the least creative of my organs. because you are, in this way, a failure. The smell of her terror was not this morning in my bed. Bless you for not pretending to know a thing you haven't. Bless you. And so there's a lot in this book I'm reading from, which is called Smith Blue, about figuring out what to bless, I guess, and where to search out our place, our positions in this world, and our positions in ourselves, and our individual bodies and the collective bodies of humanity, but also just living creation. And so I thought I would read a poem that's part of a long elegy. I'm just going to read one section of a long poem called Prayer for P. And it's an 8-part poem, but I'm going to only read section 4. I will tell you that it's an 8-part poem because it's actually an acrostic. And so each section of the poem is transcribes one line of a C.P. Kavafi poem down the margin of the page. The first letter of each line would tell you that line of the Kavafi poem. And through that form, I was able to position myself in a grief I was feeling about the loss of a friend. And so where I was very frequently working in this book about, you know, who I was in living in a world with such atrocious environmental degradation going on, and so much war and so much loss and suffering, but also so much potential for love. It sometimes got very overwhelming, and finding different forms that could help give my imagination structure was often useful. Prayer for P, 4. For a while, things had been going well. Only an ungrateful woman would complain, reaching, as ungrateful women reach, higher than is warranted or right. I want this, especially this, I want this remembered. If ever anyone was grateful, P was best known for being grateful, for she was always grateful. And of course she was grateful because for so long everything had been going fairly well. I am sure you can understand why this much I remember about her. This much only, I'm afraid. But I'll claim cartographer's liberties. I'll claim omissions for the greater good. I am grateful my imagination has been drafted for the greater good. Especially since what I mean to do is direct. I want to be your guide. I have always been afraid of steering someone incorrectly, causing, by my own shortcoming, insufficient knowledge, harm to another. It used to be they didn't know, so in those parts they drew danger. Sea scorpions, enormous octopi, leviathan. But also wonders, rising suns. The open sea is just that, open. My dictionary has 64 definitions for the word open. None of them defining how I feel now, my heart a little more open, because without her, not the memory of her, the knowledge, not the insubstantial decoys my mind sets up in lieu of her, but without the woman, friend, her embodied body, without her, this space is a little more open. And now I am left to consider if there be anything, any rare thing that might invoke her. Who she was, marvelously good. It used to be they didn't know America. Only some folks put their experience on paper. Mostly America was a dream spoken, directing another dream, directing another dream, directing another. And P, when she heard America, heard what she wanted. Even those old map makers wanted us to want, almost as much as they wanted us to fear, to get to the places beyond the places we know. This is the way, how we have always found more. Years before, P followed directions, even though this meant crossing out over the open, rough sea. And she was grateful. For a while, things went well. Since I'm being rather audacious and cataloging all the senses and talking into the life of another woman and creating all these imaginative views of the world and the body, I figured I might now move into my own creation myth. When I fell pregnant, as they say, I was trying to really write through the experience so that I could really experience it. That's part of how I understand the world is through writing. And I followed an exercise that a woman suggested to write my creation story. And so this is for Callie Violet. Out of the darkness. In the beginning was the darkness, and the darkness drew together, and the darkness warmed the darkness, and it was not alone. But some of the darkness began to pull away. The great crowd of darkness was disturbed. This is how darkness turned against darkness. Some of the darkness lost hair in the fight. This hair fell to the historians, spiders. Each relays the filaments just as she discovers them. Some of the darkness lost legs in the fight. These ran on and still dashed through dreams. Where the blood of the darkness met the sweat of more darkness, in that place, a tree. In the tree, some quaking possum. Below it, a hound. Where the tears of the darkness fell, high grass grew, through which run rivulets of an antlered herd. Whenever darkness struck darkness, one fewer in the herd, a new cat sprung from the grasses. The darkness went down and the darkness rose up. More darkness fell while some rose still. The movement of the darkness as it fought against darkness was like the movement of oceans. Soon, some of the darkness was ocean. The remaining darkness was sky. What darkness had fallen might rise. What darkness had risen might lose wind and fall. This could go on forever, the rising of darkness, its falling. Some of the darkness lost teeth in the fight. These became teeth of the ancient, vigilant shark. Some of the darkness lost nails in the fight. These became thorns in the bramble. Some of the darkness lost sight in the fight. Some of the darkness lost reason. Some of the darkness got away from the darkness. That darkness alone drew a star.
You've been listening to Camille Dungy, author of Smith Blue. You've been listening to Camille Dungy, author of Smith Blue, Suck on the Marrow, and What to Eat, What to Drink, What to Leave for Poison. And now we're going to go back to Elizabeth Bradfield with Camille Dungy.
Wow. That was so phenomenal. I want your creation myth. That's my creation myth now. We're going to adjust the microphone a bit. If there's any scattering.
I believe everybody should write their own creation myth at some point. I didn't know that I believed that until I did it, but I really felt like it was very different from what the assignment originally was, and I was surprised by what I discovered.
I have a poem in interpretive work that is a creation myth, but it's not as incantatory. And I think like going in there to this logical, illogical, language-based, image-based world, you're just in it. I mean, there's something about that poem that supersedes language, you know? And I love that about it. So I'm going to try and think of something to read in response. I guess what I think what I'll do is not try and be incantatory but I think this is a different creation myth of mine, maybe. I loved how much water was in your poems, too. I just loved hearing all of that. I've been thinking a lot about where we come from and how things make sense. And I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in Tacoma, Washington, same house until I left for college, right across the bay from the smelter. And, you know, with the trains going by and seeing log booms going into the port, and Commencement Bay that I grew up on was voted one of the top 10 most polluted bodies of water in the U.S. Awesome. But I loved it. I swam there. I ate stuff out of there. I loved it. But since growing up there, I lived in Alaska for a while. I live now on Cape Cod. I go back to the Seattle. Now all my family lives in Seattle instead of Tacoma. But I feel very connected to that landscape. And I was thinking a lot about where I come from and how the stories of my youth make sense and how they're a little bit messy also. Sometimes I get to work as a naturalist in my backyard of growing up, which is Southeast Alaska and British Columbia. And so this poem, it's a prose poem in three chunks. It's called Eagles Every Day. I don't think there's any more explanation that needs to happen, really. Eagles Every Day. Local kids put on robes and masked, we'd walked past in the museum. Materials, mountain goat hair, buttons, grizzly claws, eagle down, and context, for potlatch, to welcome back the salmon, for the dance of peace. Elders sang while the kids, in the range of attitude and attention found everywhere, danced. Wolf moved like the back row guys in my 8th grade math class, slumped, habituated. One boy took raven and was the bird. Quick stop-start tilt of eye and beak. Awkward, menaced hop. A sense of bright mind turned for a while toward you, making you strange. He must have been 13. I could see the sheen of his basketball shorts, baggy and long, at the hem of his robe. And the back of his head under the mask, black, straight hair gelled to another sheen. This at the end of a week among the bays and islands of the inside passage. Drip of cedar in rain, killer whales mid-channel, swaths of hill bright green where the timber had been sold and taken. Gillnet buoy lines, eagles every day. I grew up on Tokaloo Avenue, below Manawana and Tonawanda, above the Puyallup's outflow. On clear days, a mountain they never renamed, pinned the horizon. There was a totem pole on the lawn of my junior high that none of us ever really looked at until Todd and Wade cut it down one night with a handsaw and left it toppled in the grass. Everywhere there were stylized logos with salmon or thunderbird, tow trucks rendered in form line design. Every year we bought illegal fireworks from the reservation stands. There was head shaking about the casinos and the fishing. Talk we'd lose our house to reclamation. I drew pages and pages of black and red shapes copied from a book, ovoid, clean, and full of stories I didn't bother to learn. We sat in the cedar room with a dirt floor and regulation fire doors that was new built to show and house what had never fully leached away. We watched and listened. The all-aboard time was 3 p.m. That boy's raven. We applauded. We ate what they gave us. soap berries whipped to froth with sugar and handed out in paper cups stuck with a carved wooden spoon. The berries were sweet, sweet, then strangely bitter. We filed out, saying thank you, sincere. Someone, probably the purser, handed an envelope to the woman by the door. The kids milled out back in street clothes, and we walked down to the boat. Should I read another, or should you read one?
I'll read one in response to that one. And I'm thinking about this idea of water. So we're both West Coast people, I think, and I grew up in California. I grew up in Southern California, which is the ocean that people think about when they think about the West. It's this sort of warm and Baywatch-like. But you know, when I moved, my family moved to Iowa when I was 15 years old, and I remember in my psychology class that I had to take then my sophomore year, the Gary Nugel, my psychology teacher, was talking about meditation and relaxation, and he ran us through a meditation exercise, and he had us envision ourselves on a beach somewhere. And what I did was envision myself on the beach in the northern part of the Central Coast, and that of California, which is not the Southern California landscape. It's cold, it's gray, it's a very violent ocean. You do not swim in that ocean. It's rocky. And,
I like it.
Right. And it's the waves will just come out of nowhere and take you. And that was the ocean that I was picturing myself walking beside, which is much more like the Northwest sort of ocean. And so there was the teacher going back and forth about walking along the beach. And then all of a sudden he invoked volleyballs and people laughing. And you know, and I was like, wait a minute, you destroyed my ocean, my beach, and my idea. And so all that is to say that Liz's poem about her coast experience brought me to mind that the poem from which the title of the book Smith Blue derives, but everything, the title of the book is slightly mutated, as everything is in this book. So the poem itself is called The Blue. The Blue. One will live to see the caterpillar rut everything they walk on. Sea cliff buckwheat cleared. Relentless ice plant to replace it. The wild fields bisected by the scenic highway. Canyons covered with cul-de-sacs. Gas stations, comfortable homes. The whole habitat along this coastal stretch endangered. Everything, everyone, everywhere in it in danger as well. But now they're logging the one stilling hawk, Smith cites. The conspiring grasses, shh, shh, shh. The Coreopsis, Matoni's boot, barely spares. And netted, a solitary blue butterfly. Smith, ahead of him, chasing the stream, Matoni wonders if he plans to swim again. Just like that, the spell breaks. It's years later, Matoni lecturing on his struggling butterfly. How fragile. If his daughter spooled out the fabric she's chosen for her wedding gown, raw taffeta burled a bright-hued tan, perhaps Matoni would remember how those dunes looked from a distance, the fabric balanced between her arms, making valleys in the valley, the fan above her mimicking the breeze. He and his friend loved everything softly undulating under the coyest wind, and the rough truth as they walked through the land scratch and scrabble, and no one was there then besides Matoni and his friend walking along Dolan's Creek in that part of California they hated to share. The ocean, a mile or so off, anything but passive, so that even there, in the canyon, they sometimes heard it smack and pull well-braced rocks. The breeze, basic, salty, bitter, sour, sweet. Smith, trying to identify the scent, tearing leaves of manzanita, yelling, "This is it, here, this is it!" His hand to his nose, his eyes having finally seen the source of his pleasure alive. In the lab, after the accident, he remembered it, the butterfly. How good a swimmer Smith had been, how rough the currents there at Half Moon Bay. His friend alone with Reel and Rod Matoni back at school early that year, his summer finished too soon. Then, all of them together in the sneaker wave. And before that, the ridge, congregations of pinking blossoms, and one of them bowing, scaring up the living, the frail and flighty beast too beautiful to never be penned. Those nights Matoni worked without his friend, he remembered too. He called the butterfly Smith's Blue.
It makes me think of, you know, extinction and fragility and all the things that you're talking about in that poem, and that quest to discover, recover, that frustrated dance.
Right. But then there was the totem pole that the boys in yours cowered down. Like, there's also this destruction, right? Yeah. So the only way that we have this butterfly is because two guys pinned it, right? Yeah. The only way you notice this this other language, other communication, was because two boys pinned it, you know, destroyed it.
Yeah.
And there's a way in which we only see these things that matter to us. We only see what matters to us as it's going or after it's gone.
Yes. Or as it comes back
unexpectedly. Yes.
Which is, I mean, it makes me think of, there are two poems I want to read in response to your poem.
Okay, go.
One is a poem called, well, one of the things that I do on the Cape is help out with a project on gray seals, which are recovering after being bountied in Massachusetts until 1964. You'd get $5 a nose if you turned it into the state. They kind of disappeared from Massachusetts waters, and now they're coming back, and some people are happy and others are not. Sharks are coming back too. Some people are happy, some people are not. But this idea of the some things recovering is complicated. This poem is not about seals. It's about whales. It's about right whales, which are called right whales because they're right whale to hunt. Mm-hmm. When you kill them, they would float. And so you can get the baleen for right whales is what people really wanted, even more than their blubber. And they're the North Atlantic right whale are probably the most endangered large cetacean on the planet. Our current count is about 500 individual animals, and they're all numbered. There's also Pacific right whales and Southern right whales, but the North Atlantic right whales, about 500. And the reason their numbers are so low is because of us, because of whaling. Their numbers kind of slowly creep up. They eat plankton. They have a really limited diet. And a couple of years ago, we had 301 right whales in Cape Cod Bay.
Wow.
Which was a phenomenal number. It was just a number no one had recorded. It was unprecedented. And being there and seeing these animals, which you can see from the beach or from a boat, really shifted to see them in numbers like that. You read these accounts of people coming to the new world and walking across the backs of cod and being afraid to enter harbors because there were so many whales. And you're like, yeah, you really exaggerated a lot back in the day, but maybe not.
Right.
You know? And so to see that many whales was intense. And the plankton that they eat are these little tiny things called copepods. They're quite small, you know, less than a half of your fingernail. And they're pink They smell like watermelon. Believe it or not, they're lovely. So I'll just read this poem. Historic numbers of right whales skim feeding off Cape Cod. Who would expect their appetite would come to seem ominous? But now I know they are voids of hunger. They plow a field of plankton, turn, plow again. They strip the water like loggers on a clear cut. The bay this spring seemed overrun by stern, enormous beetles, black, vaguely military, inexorable. Poor plankton, adrift in flailing clouds, poor blushing copepods with delicate antennae, watermelon scent. You don't stand a chance. I am stunned. Week after week, right whales eat the bay down until they have to leave it. Time and proximity have made them monsters. This must be how it was before.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Liz, for sharing this hour with me. And thank you, Catherine Hastings, for making this show possible. This is a wonderful
highlight
thing
of this whole
the CWP conference.
Year? I mean, wow, I feel so lucky to sit here and hear these poems with you.
So I'm going to recite the first poem of my first book. Language. Silence is one part of speech. The war cry of wind down a mountain pass, another. A stranger's voice echoing through lonely valleys. A lover's voice rising so close, it's your own tongue. These are keys to cipher. The way the high hawk's key unlocks the throat of the sky and the coyote's yip knocks it shut. The way the aspen's bells conform to the breeze while the rapid's drum defines resistance. Sage speaks with one voice, pinion with another. Rock, wind her hand and water her brush, spells, and then scatters her demands. Some notes tear and pebble our pals. Some notes gather the bank we map our lives around.
And this is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You've been listening to Elizabeth Bradfield, author of Interpretive Work and Approaching Ice, followed by Camille Dungy, author of Smith Blue, Suck on the Marrow, and What to Eat, What to Drink, What to Leave for Poison. And then a very lovely segment of the two women in conversation together and reading poems back and forth. It was a grand time. Thanks very much to Dungy and Bradfield. Make sure you check in at wordtemple.com. There is a live reading this coming Saturday night on May 18th at the Word Temple Poetry Series, 282 South High Street in Sebastopol. The featured poets there are Hugh Martin and Gerald Fleming. Hugh Martin is an Iraq War vet, and he is the author of the chapbook, So How Was the War?, published by Kent State University Press, and his new full-length collection, The Stick Soldiers, just out from BOA Editions. Gerald Fleming has a number of poetry collections. His most recent is The Choreographer, published by 16 Rivers Press. You do not want to miss either one of these very fine poets. If you have any comments or questions about tonight's program, either for me or for Camille Dungy or Elizabeth Bradfield, you know I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening. Listening.